From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Hate crimes against Asian Americans are increasing all over the country, from grocery stores in New York City, to the New York City subway, for what some have simply described as breathing while Asian. We heard politicians say we are fighting an invisible enemy, but the president also insisted on calling the novel coronavirus the, quote, Chinese virus. Well, George Takei's childhood was marked by xenophobia. He was forced into a Japanese-American internment camp in the United States during the Second World War. So this hour on Point, xenophobia and Asian Americans in the pandemic. And George Takei joins us now. He is an actor, of course, best known for his role on Star Trek. He's an activist as well, and he joins us from his home in Los Angeles. George Takei, welcome to the program.
Good to be here. Thank you very much.
So first of all, what are you seeing? What are you hearing from members of the Asian American community about how they feel about how this nation is viewing them right now, their nation?
Well, certainly for Japanese Americans, it is an echo of what happened almost 80 years ago. I was 5 years old then, and when I was 5 years old, I was categorized as an enemy alien by my own country, the United States of America. But I was a five-year-old kid. I wasn't an enemy, and I wasn't an alien. I was an American born in Los Angeles, son of a mother born in Sacramento, California. My father was born in Japan, but he was brought to San Francisco when he was a very young man. A young boy, as a matter of fact, by my paternal grandfather. He was a widower, and so he decided to immigrate to America. So my father was born in Japan, but reared, educated, and felt very American. And yet overnight, after Pearl Harbor, we became enemy aliens simply because we looked like the enemy. But despite that, young Japanese Americans, like all young Americans, rushed to the recruitment centers to volunteer to serve in the United States military. This was an act of patriotism, and it was answered with a slap on the face. They were denied military service and categorized as enemy alien. And the curfew came down. We had to be home in the evening by 7 p.m., and we would stay home until 6 a.m. in the morning. Mm. And then my mother went to the bank to get some money and discovered that our bank accounts were all frozen. Every Japanese-American bank account was taken away from us. And then on February 19th, just a few weeks after Pearl Harbor, the President of the United States, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who during the depth of the Depression in the 30s said, "There is nothing to fear but fear itself," was swept up in that fear. The nation was swept up in fear and war hysteria and racism because we were at war with Germany and Italy as well. But they looked like German Americans and Italian Americans looked like the rest of America. Mm-hmm. We looked like the enemy. And so he signed an executive order on February 19th, 1942, which ordered all Japanese Americans on the West Coast to be summarily rounded up. There were no charges, no trial. The central pillar of our justice system, due process, simply disappeared. And we were rounded up and imprisoned in American concentration camps.
Right. Well, Mr. Takei, it is absolutely a very dark mark in U.S. history, the shameful internment of Americans, of you and your family.
With no charges.
Yeah.
No trial.
As you're describing. And you say that you hear an echo of that today?
Well, it's a very loud echo from them. What's happening today would be considered, I use the word advisedly, mild compared to what happened to us. Everything taken away from us, in the case of my parents. And we have a whole history, Asian Americans do. The immigration from Asia began in the 1840s. It was Chinese. And Chinese were involved in the gold rush, the 49ers. And that's why today in California, we have certain towns and areas called with names like Chino, which is Spanish for Chinese, or China Camp. So Chinese were here way back then. In 1871, there was a white woman in Los Angeles, in my hometown, who claimed that she was assaulted by a Chinese man, and a mob pushed into Chinatown, randomly yanked 20 Chinese men out of Chinatown, took them to the Central Plaza of Los Angeles, and lynched them. So Asian Americans have a long history, Chinese, Japanese, or today we have more, we have immigration from Asia after each war. After the Korean War, the immigration from Korea began. Yeah. And after the Vietnam War, Southeastern Asian, Vietnamese, Cambodians came, and the Filipinos. And we are all seen as the same.
Yeah.
We're Asians, and we're targeted.
Well, Mr. Takei, stand by here for a moment, because we are talking about the increased number of hate crimes that are being experienced by the Asian American community in the wake of the novel coronavirus pandemic. And so for our listeners out there, Asian Americans, is this happening to you? What are you experiencing? Now, Mr. Takei, stand by for just a moment here, because I'd like to now bring into the conversation Erica Lee. She is an immigration and Asian American historian and a professor at the University of Minnesota, author of America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. And she joins us from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Professor Lee, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Mr. Takei is providing us with an incredibly important context, a historical context about how the United States has viewed its own citizens of Asian descent and heritage. I would also like to think that we have come, hopefully, made some progress from the middle of the 20th century. Have we made progress, enough progress, or do you hear the same echoes, similar echoes that Mr. Takei was describing?
So, first of all, George has done a wonderful job providing some of the historical context. But the answer to your question, Magna, is really yes and no. Certainly, there's progress. There's much more visibility of Asian Americans, the fact that people are speaking out today, and that governments are acting, local governments are acting with helplines. And there are shows like this one to highlight acts of discrimination and racism. That's new. When the Chinese were excluded in 1882 and when Japanese Americans were forcibly removed from their homes, there was very little public response. Public support for those Asian American and Asian immigrant communities. So what we're seeing is new in that way. However, the stereotypes, the ideas that simply because you have an Asian face, you must be a carrier of the virus, the hurtful and damaging political rhetoric around the Chinese flu, or this idea that the coronavirus was, quote unquote, made in a Chinese lab, these have all revived much larger racist and anti-immigrant narratives that never go away in the United States. It's part of the U.S.'s long history of xenophobia, and in particular, it highlights the ways in which immigrants have often been tied to disease as a plague or as an invasive threat, or as carriers of contagion and disease that will then ruin the United States. We've heard this before, and unfortunately, we're hearing it again today.
So talk about that a little more, because I think we've also heard it recently, just in the past couple of years, regarding immigration from the southern border, that, you know, there are a public health argument does pop up every once in a while. It seems as if there has been an overlap between that, between immigration and public health, as you're saying, since as long as there's been a United States.
Oh, even before then, in the colonial era, yeah. When German immigrants, they were considered swarthy and alien. When German immigrants were coming over, they were blamed for bringing yellow fever. The Irish were blamed for spreading cholera in the early 1900s. Jewish immigrants were blamed for a typhoid epidemic at the end of the 19th century, et cetera. And certainly this does absolutely intersect with whatever immigration debate we are having. Mexican immigrants have long been described as being dirty, living in homes with filth and disease, bringing typhus and plague. You know, the Border Patrol was tasked in the early 20th century up through the middle of the 20th century with de-lousing Mexicans who came across the border. This would include gasoline baths that required migrants to stand there naked while they were poured with gasoline, and then in later years being sprayed with DDT. So, you know, the public health concerns and the rhetoric around immigrants and disease, what it does is that it helps to justify, it feeds, and then it justifies existing stereotypes and racism around immigrants, and then leads to discriminatory public health policies that disproportionately impact specific immigrant groups and minority groups.
Well, Erica Lee and George Takei, we just have to take a really quick break. We'll come back and talk more about what the Asian American community is thinking and feeling with the rise of hate crimes against the Asian American community in response to the coronavirus pandemic. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the rise of hate crimes against Asian Americans right now in this country. And I'm joined today by Erica Lee. She's an immigration and Asian American historian and a professor at the University of Minnesota. She joins us from Minneapolis. And George Takei is also with us from Los Angeles. He's an actor, of course, best known for his role in Star Trek and an activist as well. And Mr. Takei, I wonder if you could just tell me, frankly, what impact it had on you or on the Asian American community at large when President Trump last month, with some frequency, insisted on calling the novel coronavirus the Chinese virus.
It resounded with every Asian American, whether you're Japanese or Vietnamese or Korean or Filipino, because we look alike. And that's been historically. During the Second World War, Chinese Americans had to wear signs or little buttons saying, "I am Chinese," so that they wouldn't be mistaken for Japanese. But nevertheless, they were assaulted. So because we look alike, we are in the same basket when this kind of hate is engendered in this country. And so when Trump started repeating incessantly, continuously, Chinese virus, we immediately felt it. I'm Japanese American. My Filipino American friends immediately felt it too. Korean American friends. We're all in the same basket. And the blowback. Now, the difference between today and back 80 years ago is that we are speaking out. We are becoming participants in this democracy. And so the blowback, not only from the Asian American communities, but the more enlightened general American community, was so intense against the president that he stopped using that. But it was only for political considerations that he stopped doing it. He had already blown the dog whistle to his hate constituents. And it's still continuing to this day.
Mm. Well, Erica Lee, Mr. Takei is right. There was a lot of outcry over the president's use of the term Chinese virus. I cannot claim to know at all why he insisted on using that term. But I'm looking back at a tweet that the president sent, put out on March 23rd. And he said, in this tweet, he said, "It is very important that we totally protect our Asian American community in the United States and all around the world. They are amazing people, and the spreading of the virus is not their fault in any way, shape, or form." Then he says, "They are working closely with us to get rid of it. We will prevail together." Now, I know I heard from several people that I know that they thought the tweet was pretty good until the president used the phrase, "They are working closely together with us," implying still an otherness in the Asian American community. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. You know, so the way that xenophobia works is that there's always a they and there's always an us. And so, yes, you know, he was trying to do some damage control belatedly, I would argue. But again, that last line separated Asian Americans from the rest of the United States as not being Americans. And I think we have to understand his use of these terms, Chinese virus and others, Wuhan virus, and then the Kung flu by some politicians, as part of this larger backlash against immigration and the transformation in immigration policy that has been a centerpiece of the Trump administration. So, you know, this has to be part of that, the long record of openly racist comments about Mexicans and Muslims, et cetera.
Hmm. Well, we are talking with Erica Lee and George Takei about the rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans, which is a remarkable and disturbing change because there had been a 15-year decline in hate crimes against Asian Americans prior to this year. Let's take a quick call from Matt, who's calling from Ocean City, Maryland. Matt, you're on the air.
Hey there. How you doing?
I'm okay. Go ahead.
Good. Hey, so my question is, you know, I think there's a difference between, you know, how we discuss the Chinese government versus the Chinese people, and they're not all painted at the same brush. I think it's, you know, it's common knowledge that the virus, you know, popped up in, you know, late December, early December, and Dr. Li had tried to be a whistleblower and warn the people and the world and was subsequently silenced by the repressive regime of the Chinese government and subsequently died in mid-January. While this was going on, there was open travel. You know, many people traveled to, Chinese citizens traveled to Italy. A lot of people traveled to China. And, you know, that's how the virus spread. And the Chinese government tried to keep it a secret, but, you know, it just got out of control.
Yeah. So, Matt, I take your point. I hear what you're saying because, yes, I fully agree with you that we should be robustly skeptical and critical based on fact of governments. But we're talking here about a rise in hate crime against Americans of Asian descent. So do you have your question about that?
On a small seaside town on the East Coast, and I don't see that, and I don't see it on my online presence. You know, I don't live in L.A. or New York or anywhere that this may be happening. And obviously, I've been locked down for the last month and a half, so I haven't been outside to see mobs attacking Asian Americans. I have a lot of Asian American friends, and I don't hear them saying that they're being, you know, discriminated against or, you know, beaten up or anything like that. So And quite frankly, I haven't really seen any news reports about it either. So I'm not saying it's not happening. I'm just saying that it's if it is happening, it's you know, going to be a very you know, a minor instance or a minor occurrence of what is happening. Not to say any of the instances bad of racism and violence, obviously, but you know, I don't see it.
Right. Well, Matt,
comment on this?
Yes, please.
Matt is still referring to our ancestral land, but Asian Americans are Americans. We have been here. I mean, certain segments of the Asian American community have been here since the 1840s. We are many generations here. We are Americans. And as a matter of fact, Asian Americans are a part of the frontline troop, doctors, nurses, researchers looking for a cure. We are a part of America, and still we are seen in the context of our ancestral land. My grandparents came from Japan. In the case of many of my Chinese American friends, it's their great-great-grandparents that came from China. We are Americans, and still we're compared with, you know, in the context of our ancestral land. Yes, there are a lot of first-generation and second-generation Asian Americans, but it's the same as with our German or Italian or Irish friends. They have been here a long time, and they are part of America, despite the fact that we still have immigrants coming from Germany or Italy or Ireland.
Mm. Erica Lee, did you want to respond? Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. You know, this idea, I don't see it. It doesn't happen. This is really common in terms of the ways in which many Americans view Asian Americans as the model minority, as not victims of racism or discrimination, and it's quite unfortunate. Matt can go to the website of On Point and find a number of articles that your staff has already been put up on the rapid rise of hate crimes and discrimination across the U.S. We know that in terms of reporting of hate crimes, there's 1,000 incidents in less than 2 weeks that have been reported. We know that most incidents go unreported. So this is a silent and invisible to many rise in discrimination. But for those of us who are Asian American, even if we are not actively victims of being spat upon or being, you know, there was one woman who was had acid thrown on her face, the daily fear of walking outside, now that we are recommended to wear masks, the daily fear of being shunned or being you know, given a sidelong view because we are Asian and wearing a mask is something that every Asian American has been feeling in the past few weeks. There may not be mobs today, but there is a spectrum of hate crimes and discrimination that many Asian Americans have faced, from the social isolation to the shunning to active physical violence.
Mm. Well, Erica and George, hang on here for just a moment, because I now want to bring another voice into this conversation. Kathy Park Hong joins us from Brooklyn, New York. She's author of the new book, Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. And she also wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine on Sunday. That piece was headlined, "The Slur I Never Expected to Hear in 2020. Kathy Park Hong, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
So I don't want you to say the word, but what is it that... what is the feeling, the experience, the response that you never expected to see or hear or feel in your life in 2020?
Well, I wanted to first say that it's not like I never heard it before. Mm-hmm. It's just there's a resurgence of it, and that word is I had that word thrown at me when I was a child, but the last time I heard that term was when I was in my 20s. But then there's, with the resurgence of hate crimes, there have been, I've seen that word thrown at my friends a lot more, and I've seen it online a lot more. So there's been, rather than, there's been a resurgence of that word. And, you know, so that's been, I guess you could say it's been more intense. The racism has been more intense. And I was wondering if I could also answer Matt's question, too.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think another issue that a lot of Asian Americans are dealing with is not only do they deal with a lot of fear, which is pretty much across the board. It's universal. Every person I've talked to who's of Asian descent they're scared of leaving their home, and I've heard numerous instances of them being harassed. But another concern is that a lot of times when Asian Americans express being a target of racism, they're not believed. You know, they're constantly, the realities are constantly gaslighted. So what Matt is saying is unsurprising. You know, this is sort of how I grew up too. You know, there was racism, but because of the model minority myth, a lot of, you know, Americans just assume that there's no anti-Asian racism because we're just not visible at all. So now that it's actually happening in a really hateful way, you know, people are paying attention, but still I think a lot of people are not really acknowledging it. And I think that's also why there's not enough media attention as well. You know, I'm thankful for this radio show, but I just, you know, it's like there hasn't been as much attention as there could be on the anti-Asian racism.
George, can I just get your thoughts on that? That anti-Asian racism has been invisible or not discussed that much?
I don't think so, because we are a different Asian American from my grandparents' days. They were quiet. And when we were incarcerated, generation, my parents' generation, were so wounded and so shamed. The shame was really the government's, but they took on the shame. And so they didn't talk about it. But in this generation now, we are speaking out. As a matter of fact, right after the 9/11 horror that happened in New York City, we Japanese Americans immediately recognized its ramifications for all minority Americans. And so we organized a rally in the plaza of the Japanese American National Museum, and we invited leaders of the Muslim community here in Los Angeles, and we had a candlelight ceremony in the plaza, inviting everybody, but particularly the Muslim American community and the Japanese American community. And we, the leaders of the Muslim community, spoke out, and the Japanese American community spoke out. And because Little Tokyo is just two blocks away from Los Angeles City Hall, candlelight ceremony turned into a candlelight march, carrying our candle all the way to City Hall and back. So we connect with all of the other groups, and we are speaking out. And a lot of the initiative being taken currently on this anti-Asian problem that we have here is stimulated by Asian Americans taking the initiative. Mm. So it's a different Asian American community today.
Erica, I agree.
Kathy, go ahead. We just got a minute to go before the break, but go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to quickly say, I think Asian Americans are definitely much more empowered, younger generations, and also how Japanese Americans who were in internment camps have been very supportive of other vulnerable communities, like including not just Muslim communities, but Latinx communities as well. But Asian American history and the history of xenophobia is still not taught in general history courses. So I'm just talking about like just Americans in general, that they're still not aware of the history of racism against Asians. That's what I'm commenting on.
I see. Okay. Well, Kathy Park Hong and George Takei and Erica Lee, we have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are talking about the rise of hate crimes against Asian Americans. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow, we are going to be talking about what schooling should look like now as school buildings are closed in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic. What should the ideal education be? So we'll be talking to two University of Georgia professors who say, forget online learning, forget remote learning, forget distant learning. They are saying that this is a time to teach kids just how to be. They're calling it a moment of system decompression in public education in America. So we want to hear from you. What has been your experience in trying to continue your child's education at home? Is this making you really rethink what school should be? And what has the remote learning been like from your school? Call us with a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That is for tomorrow's show, which we'll be talking about schooling in the time of COVID-19. And today we are talking about the rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans. And I'm joined by Kathy Park Hong. She's author of the book Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. George Takei is also with us, of course, the very well-known actor and activist. And Erica Lee is with us. She's a professor at the University of Minnesota and author of America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. And we do have a couple of callers to go to. But Erica, I wanted to ask you a really quick question about something that George said at the very beginning of the show about how quickly in moments in history that one's Americanness can be taken away from them, right, and be seen as other. And, you know, he was relating the story of the internment of him and his family in a camp during World War II. Is that also part of what we're seeing now, is the speed with which people's views, perceptions, opinions about their fellow Americans change when it comes to any kind of crisis?
Absolutely. You know, this is one of the ways in which racism and xenophobia works. It doesn't go away. It may go a little bit quiet for some time, but the rapidity in which we turn against one another points to the ways in which certain stereotypes, narratives, and, you know, structural discrimination are already at work in the United States. It's been quite astounding how very old stereotypes about China, Chinese people, Chinese spaces as being, full of disease, that Chinese people eat weird things, that they may look very westernized and Americanized, but you scratch the surface and they're still that old country and unsanitary habits that lurk beneath. Those were stereotypes that first took hold in the United States in the 19th century. And it's been
incredibly interesting to see how, with the new coronavirus, how those global stereotypes have been reactivated and how effective they've been.
Yeah. George, may I ask you, you were, as you said, you were five when this happened to your family.
Yes.
So, but about what impact, what long-term impact did it have on your parents to have their Americanness be so violently removed from them?
It was destructive. Can you just imagine losing everything, every physical possession you had worked for up to the half point in your life, and to suddenly have that taken away from you, and to be imprisoned and behind barbed wire fences with sentry towers, machine guns pointed at us. When we made the night runs to the latrine, searchlights followed you. I mean, that imprisonment with all the dehumanization and the relentless, a year into imprisonment, they come down with a loyalty questionnaire trying to get us to say we weren't loyal to the Emperor of Japan. We're Americans. We never even thought of a loyalty to the Emperor. So all that. But what I like to emphasize, which I did just a while ago, about Asian Americans as a frontline medical troop there in the hospitals. But now we are active participants in the American process. We are elected officials. We are in the U.S. Senate. We are in the U.S. Congress, on the state level, in the state legislature, in our city councils. We're on public boards and commissions. We are participants in the American society. We are Americans. I keep underscoring that. Mm. And you know, that we have to keep underscoring that, because people just can't seem to separate our ancestral land from who we are today. And it's at occasions like this that looms up and starts biting us right back.
Well, let's go to some of our callers here quickly. Let's go to Pat, who's calling from Andover, Massachusetts. Pat, you're on the air.
Thank you for doing this program. My 30-year-old daughter, she's adopted from South Korea, and she grew up in Andover, and she's just recently, you know, this last month, gone out to the stores and been told to go back to China and been sneered at and growled at. And it's just very disheartening that she's an American. She grew up here. We're taxpayers. We're, you know, good citizens. And she also suffers from a chronic illness, and she's, you know, worried about the hydroxychloroquine shortage. And for her to have to, like, be, you know, experience that, everyone's on edge. And then in addition to that, she has to, in her own community, has to be, you know, experience xenophobia. It's just very disheartening.
Yeah, I'm really sorry about that, Pat, but thank you for sharing that story. Let's go to Grace, who's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Grace, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to share a recent experience I had while I was shopping at my local drugstore. The cashier was checking out customers before me, and she wasn't using her hand sanitizer bottle. And when it was my turn to check out, she looked at me and immediately reached for her bottle of hand sanitizer. And I am Indonesian American, and I've been born and raised here in Florida.
And so what did you think? How did that make you feel when that happened?
At first, it bothered me. And then I had no words or no thoughts about it, because it kind of just shocked me. And that's an instance that I'll never forget since during these times having experienced that.
Yeah. Grace, I'm sorry that happened to you, but thank you so much for sharing that with us. I'm going to try to get one more call here. Jennifer's calling from West Roxbury, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I have two daughters adopted from China when they were quite young. And we've experienced xenophobia before this outbreak. But most recently, my older daughter, who is a student at UMass Amherst, was sitting on a bench out there waiting for a friend and eating her lunch on the bench, and apparently an older gentleman sat down across from her and identified himself as a math professor and asked her where she was from, and she said she just kind of looked at him, and he said, you're not from Wuhan, are you? And she got up and left. I said, you should have just said you're from Boston. I called the dean of students and told them, and I said, you know, if this is going on with a professor, you need to do some teaching around this. This is not acceptable.
Mm.
You know, she called. My daughter called me. I was at work. It was afternoon. Very upset.
Yeah.
You know, she had not. We've heard things when she was younger, but I think that went over their heads then. But this hit her home.
Mm. Jennifer, again, I'm sorry that that happened to your daughter, and thank you for sharing that story with us. Because Kathy, I think just hearing a random selection of stories from people who decided to call us sort of emphasizes the fact that this is happening. Because I keep thinking back to our earlier caller who said, you know, he doesn't see it, doesn't seem like it's a big deal. Is this being blown out of proportion? Well, I mean, it's happening. So we've just got about a minute and a half left, Kathy. Your final thought on what it means at this moment for the Asian American community and looking forward?
It's a really scary and vulnerable time for Asian Americans that they are being scapegoated, anyone who looks East Asian. And what I want to say is allow yourself to be scared, but also allow yourself to be angry. I think some of us, I wouldn't say all of us, some of us are activists, but some of us are afraid to even be angry. And be enraged. And I'm hoping that we speak out about this hate as much as possible, and that we could be proactive about this, and we could kind of fight the racism in this country. Yes, we are American, but, you know, for so long, Asian Americans have lived a conditional existence where belonging is always promised, but belonging is never had. And what we need to do is stop following that carrot and just demand racial justice, and also ally ourselves with other African Americans and Latinx and indigenous, other minorities, and really fight for social justice. And I think we are strong, we are empowered, we're going to get through this. But I really hope that we can take our fear and then put it somewhere where it's much more proactive, where we could take our rage into something productive.
Well, Kathy,
productive action.
Yeah, Kathy Park Hong, author of Minor Feelings, An Asian American Reckoning. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And George Takei, actor and activist with us from Los Angeles. Mr. Takei, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And Erica Lee, professor at the University of Minnesota, an immigration and Asian American historian and author of America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. Professor Lee, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, in a moment, we will turn our attention to a writer in San Francisco who is running a newspaper staffed entirely by kids. This is On Point. Well, it's been quite a while since millions of American school children have been inside their physical classroom. Chris Collin is a father of a 7 and 11-year-old in San Francisco. And when California closed schools, Chris was obsessed with the question on every parent's mind, what do I do with my kids now? Also, how do we talk to kids about the pandemic? And how can parents help children put their feelings of uncertainty and upheaval into words? Well, Chris found an answer, and he shared it with us.
Before all this started, I was a journalist. I'm still a journalist. Even before San Francisco schools closed, my wife and I decided to pull our kids out, I think it was about 2 days early. Immediately we realized there was this sort of looming mini crisis on top of the actual coronavirus crisis, but for kids. There's this invisible scary thing outside that kids only had a sort of abstract understanding of, and meanwhile their world had begun to turn upside down. I fired off this email to a handful of friends and neighbors suggesting that they get their kids to write about what was going on right now, and that I would put it all together into a local pandemic kids newspaper by kids for kids. And I figured I would get a handful of replies, but I think the email started making the rounds, people started posting about it on Facebook, and before long I was getting dozens and dozens of article submissions from kids all around the neighborhood.
My name is Cora, and I am 11 years
old. My name is Anna. I'm 11 years old, and I live in San Francisco.
And then I was getting article submissions from kids beyond the neighborhood.
Toby AJ of Inda, California.
Maddie Nolan, I'm 9 years old.
My name is Dylan, and I'm 6 years old.
The articles that I started to get were sort of all over the map.
Have you noticed any rainbows in your neighborhood that are not the actual phenomena? Are you wondering why children and adults all over the country are creating rainbow masterpieces to display for all of us to spread joy and hope during this pandemic? When you are on walks with your family, don't forget to look for all the rainbows in your neighborhood. They're more than you think.
Sometimes it was direct. Sometimes kids would send in an essay about being worried about their grandparents or being lonely because they weren't seeing their friends. But other times they would be sort of these sideways glimpses of that experience.
On zebras. Zebras are black and white. It keeps horseflies from sucking their blood. Zebras might be black and white to keep themselves cool. I hate that zebras are black and white and there's no color in them.
I wrote some quarantine horoscopes. Here they are. Aries, March 21st through April 20th. You are a very energetic person and being quarantined is hard for you. You long for the fresh air and freedom of the outdoors, and you get grumpy and bored being holed up for too long. Read a thrilling book. Make something creative. Do cartwheels in your room. Do anything you need to get your mind off being quarantined.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Lettuce.
Lettuce who?
Lettuce outside. We're sick of being indoors.
Please. Seriously. When is this over? I really want to see my friends. But I like that I haven't had a bath in a week.
The world is spinning in this strange new way. We have no say in it. It can be scary and frustrating and boring and all. We have all the feelings like over the course of a day. And if kids can have just a tiny little microscopic dollop of agency in how they articulate their experience, I think that's a good and healthy thing.
Chris Collin and the many journalists who write for the newspaper 6 feet of Separation. I'm a Sagittarius. I want to know what my quarantine horoscope is, guys. Let me know. You can send me a tweet. I'm at MegnaWBUR. And that knock-knock joke, my new favorite. We got a link to that newspaper at onpointradio.org. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about learning and schooling in the age of the COVID-19 pandemic. How are you trying to keep your kids going with education? Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And let us know what you think education should be as kids are at home. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.